How Woke Won, the new Spiked book by Joanna Williams, is out now. It's all about the woke takeover of our institutions and how we, as ordinary people, can fight back. And it's also completely brilliant. Make sure you get your copy now. You can get it on Amazon or go to spiked-online.com/shop. That's spiked-online.com/shop to buy your copy. Now, on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, the Spike podcast all about freedom, the nanny state and censorship. In this episode, we discuss the fallout from Partygate, Ricky Gervais's war on woke and why Jamie Oliver can bog off. Hello, welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked. Delighted to be joined today by Patrick O'Flynn, political commentator, former MEP, and also a recent contributor to Spiked. So, Patrick, great to have you on the show.
Great to be here.
And we're also joined, of course, as we are every month, by Chris Snowden, director of lifestyle economics at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Tom. Delighted to be here. Hello, listeners. In fact, speaking of the listeners, Tom, you've got a special announcement to make, haven't you?
I do have a special announcement to make, Chris. So, from the next episode, we want to have a new feature here on Last Orders where we can hear your questions, your challenges to us, any feedback. So if anyone out there listening wants to send something in, just drop us an email at lastorders@spiked-online.com. That's lastorders@spiked-online.com. We'll answer a bunch of them at the end of next month's
episode.
Dip into
our postbag, won't we?
Exactly. We'll have the postbag section from next month. But moving on, we've got plenty to talk about today. But let's start off with Partygate. We're recording this in Westminster, the scene of the crimes, a huge landmark week for what has become a never-ending six-month-long saga now. So, of course, we're recording this on Thursday and Wednesday. The Sugray report into the Downing Street parties, these lockdown-breaking parties that we've been slowly hearing about over the course of the past 6 months. I think it's fair to say, Patrick, that it was a bit of a damp squib. There was this weird combination of all of this build-up, all of this almost like excitement from the media set. And yet when it came out, it more or less told us nothing that we didn't already know. What was your response to it?
I think if you were reading the whole report, there's a lot of fairly damning stuff in there, but there wasn't some magic one line Boris Johnson must go. So it's slightly undershot advanced expectations. I think a lot of damage has been done to Johnson because it's not just Westminster types that care about it. There's a sort of old-fashioned red wally type set of voters who are shocked that not everyone in the whole country obeyed all the COVID regulations to the letter. But it struck me as like sort of a First World War battle over a few yards of mud now. It's time for all sides to kind of bring other kind of issues into the fray.
I mean, there's plenty of other issues to talk about. Why do you think the media have become so preoccupied with this? Obviously, it's embarrassing for Boris Johnson, but it was embarrassing for him 6 months ago when this came out. Why can't they let it go, do you think?
Well, I think a lot of it boils back to Brexit. Perhaps they would have viewed in the early days Boris Johnson as a classic metropolitan liberal political class person, and they think he's betrayed that in order to get himself up the ladder. They are unreconciled to Brexit. They thought they were on the verge of cancelling Brexit, you know, with various manoeuvrings. And then Boris Johnson arrived and beat them. So I think it's a sort of Brexit derangement has morphed into a Boris obsession syndrome. And it's beginning to look unbalanced. So both sides have got pitfalls here. You know, it's definitely hurt Boris Johnson, not just among Guardian readers, which he won't particularly care about, but among some Tory considerers. But the obsession with it is also damaging for the left-wing parties. And obviously, we're all watching what will happen to Keir Starmer as regards Durham Police, which could be, you know, a surprisingly entertaining denouement.
At least another act left of this whole scandal. Chris, what did you make of this report? You scandalised by it.
Well, I didn't read it, obviously. I didn't read it because I don't care about it. But, I mean, the bits I read about it seemed, you know, pretty incredible. And if I'd known about it at the time, I'd be absolutely hopping mad. It's just that it happened so long ago and there's so many other things to worry about. And, you know, basically, I just want to forget all about COVID, really. It started as, you know, that he was been given a birthday cake on his birthday, and you think, all right, well, the guy's in his office, someone brings him a cake, what's he supposed to do? Tell him to piss off, you know, you go, okay. So, but that was the only one he got fined for, weirdly. Yeah. And then it's a picture of him clearly just raising a glass, toasting somebody's leaving. You think, well, that's probably fair enough. And then you find out there were people throwing up in the corridors at 4 o'clock in the morning at these so-called work events. You just go, well, this is just unbelievable, really. And it, as I say, if I'd known at the time, I'd be furious about it. But now I just don't care. I'm really just interested in what the political ramifications are because I have no way of knowing whether the only people who care about this are like Lewis Goodall and Beth Rigby, or if actually, you know, half the country is furious about it and will never vote Conservative again. I have no idea. And I wouldn't even trust the opinion polls on it, because if you ask people, yeah, are you angry about this or whatever, of course they're going to say yes. Whether they'll still be angry about it in 2 years' time, I'm kind of doubtful, but that's probably coloured by my own opinion about it, which is just, I just don't think it's important at all.
Now, the impression you seem to get is definitely that it has infuriated people. And if you ask them on principle, should he go or whatever, you'll get a pretty strong majority for that in the polls and what have you. But, you know, there was a Sky News journalist, a kind of lower ranking reporter, who tweeted, whenever they go outside of London to ask people about this, they just get mobbed by people saying, why are you still going on about this? So it seems people can hold those two thoughts in their heads at the same time, which is, yes, it was bad and I was angry about it 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months ago.
Right.
But now it seems to have run its course. It was strange, because it's worth underlining, I think, just how weird a lot of the media has been over the course of the past week in particular. That slow build-up you had, there was that Panorama episode where you had Laura Koonsberg talking to former Number 10 staffers with their faces blurred and their voice obscured, like they were in witness protection or something. You know?
I didn't see that either. That sounds quite funny.
It's really quite funny. And then also on the same day, I think Sam Coates was out in Downing Street kind of shouting shrilly.
Are you going to resign, Prime Minister?
My favourite was saying to Sajid Javid, are you proud of this government, Sajid Javid? Just as a perfect encapsulation of the very strange road they went. I don't know what it is. I mean, it seems like a lot of the media got very attached to kind of enforcing lockdown rules anyway. It kind of brought out the curtain twitches in them and then mixed in with this general anti-Boris sentiment. But, you know, the media is often referred to as out of touch, Patrick. Do you think this is another example of this? Because it's not as if there's an absence of other things to talk about.
Not so much out of touch as sort of partly blind to how the rest of the country views politics, because I think the media, the overall political media, are acting as if Boris Johnson is the only prime minister or party leader indeed who isn't entirely truthful all the time. And you look back at the last 5 years in British politics and you think, well, you know, the leader of the Labour Party, who was their Brexit spokesman, stood up on the eve of the 2017 election and promised as a matter of honour that Labour would fulfil and respect the referendum result, and then spent several years conspiring against it and eventually turned to a second referendum policy. And you think of Boris's predecessor, Theresa May, and the worst thing she ever did, we were told, was run through a farmer's field of wheat. And yet, yeah, she promised time and again, and you know, that her thing would be to implement the Brexit result. And then I remember her standing up in the House of Commons at one point and threatening the country with no Brexit at all. So if you're, like I obviously am, one of 17.4 million people who voted to leave the European Union and viewed that as the most important democratic moment of recent decades, and you've lived through a period in which all these other senior politicians have actually tried to cancel and steal your vote, and the media, as a rule, particularly the broadcast political media, haven't noticed because they're full almost exclusively of Remain voting people, and they just don't feel it. And then they're trying to elevate Partygate beyond its natural importance. That's pretty annoying. And you know, that's why in the end, I think Boris Johnson has got a chance to rebuild his appeal and win the next election.
See, I kind of forgiven those people as well. And I used to hate very, so much very all the people. I didn't realize how much forgiveness is in my heart. I am very petty, vindictive, and full of, you know, vendettas normally. But it just seems a long time ago. And what they did was much worse than what anybody in the cabinet office did, pretty much. Certainly worse than what Boris Johnson did. So I just think, let sleeping dogs lie.
I mean, the piety from that section has been quite funny. I was on the radio with Dominic Grieve the other day, and he started holding forth about standards in public life and trust and democracy. Gave me a great open goal, which was nice.
What's he doing with himself, Dominic Grieve, these days?
Oh, no idea. Nothing. Bumping around the manor house. I don't know
what he does. Popping up on TV, talking about
I mean, he's one of those kind of roll callers, like if David Gawk's busy, I'll go to him.
So he was there talking about Partygate?
Yeah, of course. Right. That was the main issue at the time. But no, the presentism from the media has been fun. I mean, Robert Peston had a piece out on The Spectator talking about why this is the most damning report of government conduct in his lifetime. So people were, you know, saying, well, what about Chilcot? Or even what about the Afghanistan report that came out earlier this month? You know, putting Alsatians on a plane where humans should have been out of Kabul and all the rest of it. But just to close this section out, Patrick.
I'll never be able to forgive Robert Peston, by the way.
For anything, no.
Just one of those...
Can't be done with him.
Actual vendettas. But Patrick, what do you think is going to happen with Keir Starmer at this point? Do you think he has been kind of hoisted by this? I mean, so much depends on what Durham police do, but do you think in the same way that damage has already been done to Boris Johnson, has Keir Starmer come out of this particularly well, do you think? Or?
No, I think it's brought out his pomposity and priggishness, and a lot of people have just concluded they don't like him very much. So he's not as directly damaged as Boris Johnson, but he's carrying that forward. He seemed very plodding. The self-righteousness where he spun himself as this, or he obviously sincerely believes himself to be a man of extraordinary virtue and didn't really, clearly, you know, what he did, don't want to go on about it, but on Brexit hasn't really kind of entered his head or the head of any of his team that this might be a stretch to say that you're the most honest man in politics in decades or imply that. I suspect he won't be fined by Durham police, but I also think there might be some sort of borderline stuff where other staffers, because I think we think people got highly drunk at that thing as well, do get fined, or it's a grey area, Dominic Cummings style thing where if we'd stumbled upon this, we would have advised people this wasn't appropriate. Mm. So anything like that is very useful for the Tories and to spread the idea they're all at it. Because in the end, the idea of they're all at it about politics tends to favour the centre-right over the centre-left anyway.
So we should move on to one of Chris's probably closest held vendettas, which is Jamie Oliver, who has been back in the news. Last week, he was holding this pretty funny protest outside Downing Street, the Eat and Mess protest, against the government's decision to pause its ban on buy one, get one free and kind of other meal deals on junk food. Chris, you want to tell us a bit more about what he's been up to?
I don't even hate Jamie Oliver as such. I just think he's an idiot. And I hate the media more for giving him so much time and never challenging him. That's the most annoying thing. He was on Channel 4 News. He was on Sky News. He was on LBC, I think, on and around this so-called protest. And the media just treat it like a celebrity interview. Like, we're just rolling out the red carpet. We're so pleased to have you on. They don't treat it like this is a political activist and I should challenge what he says, you know? And it's so irritating because even celebrities like, you know, Quentin Tarantino get challenged when they go on Channel 4 News. Jamie Oliver's just like, yes, sir, you know, thank you very much for your time, which is frustrating because what he's saying is highly controversial. And if Twitter's anything to go by, it did not go down well with a lot of the public. A lot of the public, of course, I never forgiven him for the Turkey Twizzlers episode. It was beyond parody, really. So he turns up with this massive high sugar, high calorie, high fat dessert, the Eat and Mess. Now, clearly there's supposed to be a bit of a joke there because Boris Johnson went to Eaton and he's making a mess of the Child of the Beastie strategy or whatever rubbish he says. But it's still junk food, like many times over, according to this definition. And he's holding it up and it's very mixed messages from it to me. And I still don't know what to make of it, but I don't think there's any hidden meaning that I haven't already spotted. It just seems to me this is a guy who's going, this is delicious food I made myself, and this is okay, but lots of other food that actually you wouldn't consider to be vaguely unhealthy. You can't buy food on a 2-for-1 or a 50% extra deal or what have you. You know, 40% of the food in this country is bought on one of these type deals. It's not just buy one, get one free. It's also 50% extra or anything like that. So he is protesting during a cost of living crisis against people having access to cheaper food. That's basically what it comes down to. He's a multimillionaire and he's turning up with some junk food in his hand with a handful of people around. It wasn't even a protest. It was just a publicity stunt. And he was publicizing this on national TV on his Twitter account, which has about a million followers. And he still only managed to get a handful of journalists and some of his employees from one of his little front groups called Bite Back to turn up. And probably a few people just walking up, a few tourists probably stopped and said, oh my God, it's Jamie Oliver, whatever. And the government has ignored it. There was not even like they were going to abandon this policy. They were just only delaying it for a year. They'll still bring it in, I would think. I hope there's real protest if they do try and bring it in 2023. But the optics of the government bringing this thing in October, when inflation is predicted to peak, were terrible. Obviously, they had to cancel it pretty much. And Jamie Oliver, I think, has made a fool of himself and shown how out of touch he is by complaining about it.
What did you make of this weird spectacle?
Well, I largely agree with Christopher on this. I saw memories of Jamie Oliver. He seems to have this strange obsession with railings. Do I remember back in the day, there was a comprehensive school in Rotherham where the mums were putting chips through the railings because the kids didn't want to eat so-called healthy food. And now it's the Downing Street railings. I very much agree he's a sort of media untouchable. And, you know, the media untouchables, the showbiz people, the so-called national treasures, seem to now be kind of taking over a lot of politics because they do have this free pass. They're never properly scrutinised. And, you know, Christopher was referring to Channel 4 News there and the difference between a Channel 4 News interview of a politician, you know, the classic, why is this lying bastard lying to me? And then a showbiz person on to plug their latest mediocre thing where it's practically like a royal visitation. And I think there's something quite unhealthy in that. And if I were in the position of a Jamie Oliver, I'd definitely, to use an old fashioned phrase, wind my neck in a bit. Obviously, with the cost of living crunch so extreme and possibly peaking in the autumn, the pragmatic thing to do has been to knock this back for a year. We all know with Boris Johnson that he responds to pressure. So Christopher's hope of getting it permanently scrapped, you know, there might now be some mileage in that, and maybe that's what the other side of the debate fears.
I mean, the sort of class hatred of these sorts of anti-obesity campaigns, I feel like Jamie Oliver has been quite a nice encapsulation of that. Again, kind of shaming those women for passing McDonald's. But I remember he once called parents who give their kids soft drinks arseholes, tossers and idiots. The obese poor think in a different gear. And poorer Britons choose to eat, quote, chips and cheese out of styrofoam containers while sitting in a room with a massive fucking TV. Which I think is a nice kind of summation of where he is. Because obviously the good thing about that protest is that he's trying to present this as I'm railing against these out-of-touch toffs.
Yeah.
But, you know, these measures are always regressive anyway.
This is
but it's clearly motivated by that kind of attitude.
This is one of the reasons he's unpopular with a lot of people kind of on the left, you might describe them as. And he's unpopular with so many people, it's a miracle that he still gets presented as a national treasure. So people like Jack Monroe hate him, right? Because she thinks quite rightly that he has his patronising and insulting view of people on low incomes. All millennials hate him because of turkey twizzlers. People like me, libertarians, whatever, hate him. So who actually likes him? Why is he always on TV? Why has he constantly got these shows? Who is it? Is it like Mumsnet people or something who like him? I don't know.
If we came out on the trans debate, maybe they'd rally him.
Yeah.
But Chris, you made a point there about how they haven't scrapped this ban on these deals. They've just paused it for a year. But surely, you know, if it's regressive to do it now because it's going to punish poor, surely it's going to be regressive to do it in a year or two's time when, you know, their finances still not be in a brilliant state.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to abolish poverty by October 2023.
But yet nothing can shake them out of this, it feels like. We should go on to someone who's actually been a bit more heroic, I suppose, over the course of the past week, or at least has made a splash in the whole woke discussion. So Ricky Gervais has just got a new Netflix special out, which I'm sure will be quite popular with the women on Mumsnet, insofar as it has a pop at woke ideology, gender ideology. There's a specific clip which is done around, which we're going to play a bit of before we discuss it.
The old-fashioned women. Oh, God. You know, the ones with wombs. Oh. Those fucking dinosaurs. No, I love the new women. I know the new women. They're great, aren't they? You know, the new ones we've been seeing lately. The ones with beards and cocks. They're as good as... they're as good as gold. I love them. No, it's the old-fashioned... And now the old-fashioned... They go, oh, they want to use our toilets. Why shouldn't they use your toilets? For ladies. They are ladies. Look at their pronouns. What about this person isn't a lady? Well, his penis. Her penis, you fucking bigot. What if he rapes me? What if she rapes you? You fucking turf whore.
So that was Ricky Gervais talking about the old-fashioned women and these new-fashioned women he much prefers with their beards and cocks in this race. Patrick, this has made a huge stir. I mean, he's been accused of being another one of these comedians who is passing off bigotry as comedy. All the LGBT groups have had a go at him. I mean, he's just stating what most people think, maybe just in a slightly cruder fashion, surely.
Absolutely. There seems to be this rule that's been invented by people like Nish Kumar or Marcus Brigstock. Well, the real rule is never be funny, but they would categorize it as you must never punch down, you must never mock the afflicted. And, you know, I've got a more old-fashioned view of comedy of, you know, why not? If it's funny, it's funny. But I do see Ricky Gervais, it's an important cultural, political moment, I would say. And the overreach of militant trans and the capture by the militant trans movement of large parts of our politics, the civil service, the political parties, you're seeing that swing back. Keir Starmer in particular has been very discomforted. I will pick out, again, a very ambitious politician at the moment is Penny Morden, who's got a lot of people scurrying around saying she's the future, she's the next Conservative leader. She has a video clip she probably wants to forget now in the House of Commons chamber when she stood up and said, trans men are men and trans women are women, you know, Conservative so-called contender there. Well, now I think we've got a Tory MP, is it Mark Jenkinson, perhaps, who's come out and boldly said trans men are not men, trans women are not women, which is sort of biologically accurate. And the tide's gone out. And to use that phrase, we can see who's wearing any swimming costumes. And on this, there's a lot of politicians who swallowed this ideology ridiculously, and they're in tricky positions. And you know, I'm someone who always thought that, you know, women's loos, women's gyms, women's sport, in particular women's prisons, hospital wards needed protecting on a biological basis. And hopefully we're going to drive this ideology into the sea.
What do you think, Chris? Do you think it was a big moment in this whole discussion? I mean, it's only a couple of 24 hours out, but still.
Well, possibly a bit. I mean, I watched it last night. I thought it was very good. I thought it was one of his best ones. Some very good jokes in there. I kind of like the way he just went straight into it. You know, like, it's like Dave Chappelle stuff. He kind of does it relatively delicately and he builds a story around it and then, you know, has a little jab here, a little jab there, whereas Ricky Gervais is like, like the bloke in the pub who's only just heard about this stuff. And that's his immediate reaction to it, you know? I mean, can we say that Gervais tries to have his cake and eat it a little bit, right? I mean, he just says later on in the special that, you know, obviously he believes in trans rights, and trans rights are human rights, and he was on the BBC saying that, look, he jokes about everything and it's just a persona and all this kind of stuff. And this is kind of the justification people like Jimmy Carr have used as well. And to some extent it's true. And obviously there is a perfectly respectable type of comedy which involves just saying the most outrageous thing, okay? And Gervais says, look, I do jokes about Hitler and all sorts, obviously not going to be taken seriously. Fine. But there's also such a thing as satire, okay? And I think what he was doing was satirizing something that most people find ridiculous, and that's where the laughter came from. And a lot of the laughter, you know, the people laughing at it weren't going, oh, that's a brilliant kind of caricature of a bigot, and I'm laughing at the... They weren't laughing at the bigots, they were laughing at the jokes. And it wasn't just a laugh, it was a massive round of applause as well, right? It was the laughter of recognition and relief. So for Ricky Gervais to come along and say, well, obviously I don't mean any of it, I think he does mean some of it. I think he actually does think that it's wrong for, you know, women who were born a man and have a penis to be sent to a women's prison. And he's with 90%+ of the population probably on that. So I do think, and he's been doing this for a long time, Ricky Gervais, he does try and have it both ways. Mm-hmm. But it's still a great special and, you know, a quite a funny clip, I thought.
It's amazing how little you have to do to be outrageous on this particular right. question. I mean, as you say, just sort of just, and Fraser Myers, who is actually in this podcast but sat behind the microphones, pointed this out, that all you have to do is actually say what these people think, really. You just have to repeat it in the most clear way possible. And it really...
that's what Julie Bindle said as well on Twitter. She said, what they're complaining about, they're just being quoted verbatim.
No, exactly. Incredible stuff. But there does seem to be more of this in the mainstream now. I mean, it tends to be kind of millionaires, comedians, or millionaire children's authors who are able to make these particular points. But you do feel like things are starting to break up. Patrick, you're talking a bit about politics there. How important do you think these issues are for voters? So you've talked a bit about how this has tripped up not just members of the Labour Party, but members of the Conservative Party. There's often this argument between kind of Westminster wonks and pollsters and all the rest of it about how this is a sort of non-issue. Either it's a non-issue or the Tories are stirring it up for dodgy reasons. They can't decide which of the two it is. But how important do you think these kinds of issues are for voters in the country?
I think they're really important. I think over the last 5 or 6 years, the politics of culture and identity has been more important. Obviously, we're now into a new phase where, you know, people are potentially suffering 5 or 10% drops in living standards in a calendar year, which evens up the terrain a little bit. And economics, you know, it's not just a matter of can I afford half a new Mars bar if we have 500,000 more migrants. It's now, you know, serious amounts of money at stake. So obviously, cost of living and economics are going to be the predominant factor for at least the next couple of years. But nonetheless, underlying it, it's really important. And the people who try and scare particularly the Conservatives off broaching this stuff, I think probably know it's important. They just don't like it themselves. Mm-hmm. Boris Johnson has been quite successful now at presenting himself as on the side of biology on the trans issue. But, you know, he's not really. We saw him at the last Tory conference go along to Carrie's Stonewall gig, for instance. There's still the legal position around gender reassignment and what it's deemed to mean and how you are able to enact that as an individual. You know, that the law is still not really satisfactory from a point of view of protecting biological women. So he's a bit of a fence sitter. And I think on a whole load of things, Boris Johnson is just sort of striking postures, really. And you don't get the feeling of a great political thinker with his shoulder to the wheel on any particular cause.
Mm. It's interesting as well, because as you say, a lot of people are trying to sort of pretend like this has become a distraction again. You've seen a kind of flurry of those sorts of think pieces in The Guardian, etc. You know, the Tories have been weaponizing this issue. Meanwhile, there's been this big cost of living crisis. The culture war is a distraction, often from people who have found themselves very distracted by the culture war in recent years. It's always quite interesting.
It's always somebody else who starts a culture war, isn't it?
Exactly. And then when someone...
it's always the other side.
I would like to go into that women's prison. I don't think you should. How dare you start this culture war? It's always the way these things plan out. But, you know, but also, especially the trans thing, probably more so than arguably many of the other issues that we find ourselves talking about, has a very material impact on women's lives. I mean, the women's hospital wars thing I thought was fascinating, because a few years ago, it was a mark of shame if a health secretary hadn't managed to reach this point where you could definitely guarantee women's wards in relation to hospitals. And now that's become a controversial position. But Chris, just to close this out, do you think the tide's turning? Do you think these unsayable things are suddenly becoming a lot more sayable in public life?
Well, I think they obviously are, judging by the massive round of applause on that special, which obviously was then broadcast on Netflix, and Netflix have told their employees to go elsewhere if they don't like Netflix broadcasting these things. They are mainstream issues. Obviously, there's a danger of us sat in Westminster saying no one cares about Partygate. What they really care about is like identity politics. You know? We may well not have our finger on the pulse on this, but certainly the identity politics thing is much more, far more people are aware of it and concerned about it than was the case a few years ago. And far more people are aware and concerned about it than a lot of people often assume. And there are, you know, a lot of private conversations and WhatsApp groups and what have you where this stuff is being discussed, but because it can't be discussed openly a lot of the time. So I think it's one of the Tories' few wedge issues, considering they go along with Labour with all sorts of other things like windfall taxes. And I think Boris Johnson will push it. I noticed the other day in Prime Minister's Question Times when he was getting taken to the cleaners, really, on the on the whole Partygate thing, Boris just tried to change the subject and said, yeah, but you don't know what a woman is.
Just out of nowhere,
So he's, I mean, he's kind of scraping the barrel with it, but he obviously thinks it's a powerful weapon. I think, to be fair, it probably is.
On that positive note.
But tell us what you think, listeners. At lastorders@spikes-online.com.
Chris, Patrick, thank you very much. You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked,